National Radio Club. Heidi Xers, welcome to Market Scope for June 2012. This month we're digging into the AirCheck Library and going back 24 years to KMPS, Seattle.
94 Country, KMPS presents the original Freewheeling Radio Sweepstakes. Listen to Ichabod Kane and the Waking Crew weekday mornings at 7:15 for details on how you could win. Here's just one of the 40 new cars and trucks you can choose from.
Freewheeling package number 29 is a Toyota standard bed pickup from Tenney's Toyota. Four-speed manual transmission with styled steel wheels and more. Perfect for any truck lover, now on display at Tenney's Toyota, 133rd and Lake City Way. Tenney's is America's oldest Toyota dealer in business since 1946, with new and used cars and a complete parts and service department. Tenney's is a quality dealer award winner, now featuring Freewheeling package number 29, a Toyota standard bed pickup from Tenney's Toyota.
You could also win free groceries, cellular phones, car audio systems. Plus, when you use the money-saving coupons in your KMPS Freewheeling Sweepstakes brochure, you'll automatically be entered in our weekly drawings for a trip or two to Reno on American Airlines with accommodations at the Reno Hilton. It's the original Freewheeling Radio Sweepstakes. Listen for your chance to win only from 94 Country KMPS.
We got friends. Morning, friends.
Yay! Hey, what up, dude?
Tomorrow's a stay-home day.
Give yourselves a hand, you made it.
Four Country KMPS at 5:58. Two before six. Ichabod, the Waking Crew, and Waylon on KMPS.
I've been down the Mississippi.
Ramblin' Man Waylon on 94 Country KMPS. Good morning. Ichabod K, the Waking Crew. Friday at 6 o'clock.
57 and cloudy at KMPS. I'm Don Riggs. Here's what's happening this hour. Nobody's sure how long raw sewage has been leaking into the Cowlitz River from a leaky pipe. At 56 and cloudy in Tacoma, 55 and cloudy in Seattle. I'm Don Riggs, and that's what's happening.
This is the Thursday morning edition of Ichabod Kane and the Waking Crew. Now, from our bureau in Washington, here's Ichabod Kane.
94 Country.
I love it.
I found you.
He accuses me of getting the time wrong.
I stay.
94 Country KMPS. Ichabod Kane, the Waking Crew at 9 after 6. 6:09 and T. Graham Brown.
Darlene.
T. Graham Brown, Darlene. At 6:12. 12 minutes after 6. Good morning.
Hi there.
94 Country KMPS. Ichabod Kane and the Waking Crew. We got some birthdays to mention. Tom Horn, happy 45th. Tom would like to thank the Metro bus driver for flagging him down to let him know he had lost his mattress.
How could you miss a thing like that?
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, it's tied up there. You don't realize it's... I left a milkshake up there before. That was about as dramatic as I get. Naomi, happy 10th anniversary from Darwin. Carol Adams at 53 still has freckles and is darn proud of it.
All right.
And let's wake up Ms. Bubba and sing happy anniversary to her.
Ms. Bubba.
Ms. Bubba.
Bubba's wife.
Hello?
Hi, Ms. Bubba. Ichabod, Don, and Patty are calling to sing to you today. doesn't sound like you were up with a cough-a-pot. Cough-a-potty-cot going.
It's going to be another one of those days.
I don't know.
I miss you tend bar at the Redmond Eagles, don't you?
Yeah, sure do.
Or did you work last night?
Did too.
Oh, that's why Mr. Bubba wanted us to do this.
Uh-huh. Bubba, he's a mean man.
As you well know, Bubba is the fishmonger at Pike Place Fish.
Hey, that Bubba.
Miss Bubba is his wife here. So it's been 11 years?
Right.
How do you stand the smell of him coming home at night?
Happy anniversary to you. Happy anniversary to you. Happy anniversary,
Mr. and Ms. Bubba.
Bubba.
Didn't Reba say that Reba is the feminine version of Bubba?
May very well be.
I think she did.
Happy anniversary to you.
The Bubbas met at Golden Gardens. Actually, you were with different dates, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right.
And you just ended up switching?
Off in the woods there. Yeah.
Well, when you sniff out the right person, you go for them, I guess. Hey, happy anniversary, Bubba's.
Oh, thank you. You sounded great even this time.
Thank you. See ya.
Linwood Honda, your dream dealer.
We got friends. Morning, friends.
It's National Bosses Day. We're inviting you to tell us about yours, something special or funny, for that matter. That's Frymo Cole, and it gets underway coming up at 6:40.
94 Country KMPS.
It's lonely out to play.
Without a doubt, one of the most beautiful voices on the planet, DJ Thomas. 94 Country KMPS, 19 minutes after 6. 6:19 and... a little bit of wet, I see. High about 60, but otherwise some partly sunnies for our weekend. Back, I'm Blue, Desert Rose Band on 94 Country KMPS. It's 6:22, 22 after 6. Ichabod Kane. Doesn't surprise me that all the polls thus far are saying that Bush won last night, since it was 2-1.
Huh?
Well, Dukakis kept saying, I'm seeing another George Bush, so he was clearly outnumbered. Love the line. It kept coming up. KMPS traffic, let's check it at 6:23. Here's our princess of the pavement, Patty Park.
This report brought to you by U.S. West Cellular. We've had a bunch of accidents already this morning. I can't believe this. An injury accident on Pacific Highway South at South 272nd. Report of a smoking disabled vehicle on the east side on 405 southbound, just south of 112.
Is it in the non-smoking
zone? It's in a non-smoking zone. That's a problem. And in Purdy on Highway 16 at 302, at Highway 302, a truck either lost a load or lost a boat. We weren't sure. It's hard to hear from that far away, but we throw that in so that we can say good morning to our friends at Purdy. We don't hear from them very often.
And they're making up for yesterday when there was not much for you to talk about there.
There you go.
Okay, we got a cloudy day, 60 for a high, maybe a little sunshine tomorrow afternoon. It's 59 right now at KMPS.
An hour drive to work adds up to 6 weeks a year in traffic, but with mobile phone service from U.S. West.
The sale's on now.
Come on.
It is 6:26, 26 after 6, and the Entertainer of the Year on KMPS, Hank Jr.
All around.
94 Country KMPS. Starting your day. Howdy, it's Ichabod and the Waking Crew. By the way, this is the home of the original freewheeling radio sweepstakes. Got your car picked out that you want?
59 and cloudy at KMPS. I'm Don Riggs. Here's what's happening this hour. I'm Don Riggs, and that's what's happening.
94 Country KMPS.
Continuous Country KMPS with the real difference. Great country songs played 12 in a row. 94 Country KMPS. Continuous Country KMPS. At home, in your car, anywhere you go. Keep your radio locked on 94 FM for more great country songs, 12 in a row. 94 Country KMPS. Continuous Country KMPS plays one great country song after another, 12 in a row. Write it down, 94 Country KMPS. Nobody plays more great country songs back-to-back than Continuous Country KMPS. 94 Country KMPS. KMPS color radar weather for Seattle, Tacoma, and Redmond. Cloudy with occasional rain today. Night drizzle and light wind, low of 48. And tomorrow, partly sunny and a little bit warmer. It's 57 at KMPS.
As you walk away.
94 Country KMPS with the Judds wrapping up 12 great country songs in a row, including the new one from Restless Heart. That's called A Tender Lie. And the latest from Tanya Tucker, Strong Enough to Bend. 94 Country KMPS congratulates Janine Walsh. She got one of the coupons from the back of her KMPS freewheeling brochure to us and won a trip to Reno this morning with Ichabod Kane and the Waking Crew. You could be next. Check the back of your KMPS freewheeling brochure for details. And if you don't have a freewheeling brochure, send us a self-addressed stamped envelope right away so we can get you one, and then you can pick out which one of the 38 remaining cars you like the best. And have a great weekend from KMPS. In less than 20 minutes, another 12 in a row. And coming up, Randy Travis's latest song on 94 Country KMPS.
Diamonds may be forever.
KMPS, good afternoon. Both sides claim victory after last night's presidential debate. Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis is in town for a rally at Pike Place Market, 4:30 this afternoon. Country KMPS welcomes the living legends of country music to Seattle. Loretta Lynn, Conway Twitty, and George Jones close out Country Music Month 2 at the Coliseum Sunday, October 30th. One show only, so call Ticketmaster to reserve your seats. Those tickets already on sale. 94 Country KMPS.
And that wraps up another Market Scope. Remember, if you'd like to profile the stations in your market or have some outstanding station you like, send your recordings to me, Phil Wayne, at 7545 County Highway 71, Harpster, Ohio, 43323-9364. The audio service membership would be most grateful for your contribution. Next up are the musings from the members.
This is Musings of the Members.
This is Tim Hendel. I really liked the letter from the general manager of KKAY in Baton Rouge on the May DX audio service. To everything that man said, I say, right on.
Hello, fellow DXers. Wayne Ryan in Brantford, Ontario. Well, it seems to be a resurrection coming. About a year and a half ago now, 1220 CHSC in St. Catharines, Ontario, went off the air. They hadn't got a license renewal. But now I understand that there are some people going to put the station back on the air. The towers are still up, and it's going to resurface as a rock station. I'm sorry to hear of the death of Carl Bean in an automobile accident on Wednesday, May the 9th. He was the PA announcer for the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park, and he started his radio career as a sportscaster back in 1973. He was very well liked, in my estimation.
Hi, Fred. This is Mike in Aventura, Florida. CBS Radio Network, are they related to CBS Broadcasting Company and people that own, for example, the CBS radio stations, the big chain of CBS stations? And does CBS Radio Network still have their features on, like Charles Osgood?
This is Rusty Curry in Eugene, Oregon. Victor Smith's FM skip tape reminded me of the best sustained FM skip I ever got. This was back in June of 77. We were living 20 miles south of Eugene or so, and the local stations were fewer then, which meant more clear spots. They were also weaker in the range of 3 kilowatts or so that I could turn the antenna southeast, and sometimes the skips would just ride right over top of the locals. This was in mid-afternoon, and it lasted for several hours. First of all, Northern Arizona came in, which probably would be Sholo and Flagstaff, and then it switched southward, and I got a bunch of Phoenix and Tucson stuff, and then all that faded out, and I was just getting one non-commercial from Raymond, New Mexico, and I remember they played Cheap Perfume and Candlelight by Waylon Jennings, and there was a woman speaking what I would guess might be Navajo. So then that faded out, and a bunch of Albuquerque stations came in, and shortly followed by El Paso. So this was really great. It was like flying in a plane over across the Southwest with a radio. 73s, everyone.
Booney in Omaha gave me the following information. 1290, KCAR is no more. It's back to the mighty 1290, KOIL.
And that is our musings to the members on this edition of the DX Audio Service. And if you'd like to muse, give us a call at 419-741-0205, 24 hours a day for DX Audio Service and EDXN members. And to answer Mike Lance's question, I have not heard any stations using those features in a long, long time. I used to use them very faithfully when I worked in radio and was the operations manager of a station, because we would sell those features. So we loved to have that kind of material, as well as the stuff fed down via Copley Radio Network. But in checking my CBS box, the only thing I could find was...
CBS News, I'm Pam Coulter. After weeks of sliding, the Dow reversed course today. The surge of 200...
There's been lots of competition over the 180 years since he arrived here, but Silas Doty remains Michigan's greatest thief ever. This is Joe Donovan in the city the French found that Americans built and automobiles enriched, where Doty found refuge after things got too hot back east.
It's back to school this summer for thousands of kids in the Detroit public schools. I'm Greg Bowman, and this is Making the Grade. The district is notifying parents this week about DPS's summer school program, which focuses on...
I'm Marie Osborne, and this is Made in Michigan. For 100 years, Gardner White has been selling furniture to Metro Detroiters. Steve Tracy is the president. His wife's family bought the business from the Gardner and White families in the 1950s.
I listened for a little while, and I didn't hear anything else come down the line, so I think that's all there is, Mike. Like I said, I used to use those CBS features along with Copley Radio Network, as well as having our own staff read material which was fed down the AP wire. And we made a lot of money doing those on our radio stations. So I'd like to see stuff come back. But, you know, times have changed. Speaking of change, here's Mark with an interesting story.
In National Archives Threats, a Radio Detective Gets His Man by Del Quentin Wilbur and Lisa Ryan, published May 2nd, 2012. J. David Golden, an eccentric 69-year-old with a handlebar mustache and an obsession with radio, was trolling eBay one evening in September 2010 looking for old radios and recordings when he spotted an item that piqued his interest. The master copy of a broadcast radio interview with baseball legend Babe Ruth as he hunted for quail and pheasants on a crisp morning in 1937. For a moment, Golden contemplated bidding on the recording. It was the kind of historic recording that would fit perfectly in his collection of more than 100,000 radio broadcasts, all of which are meticulously enhanced and preserved on tapes stored in thin white boxes on a maze of shelves in his humidity and temperature-controlled basement vault. Then Golden leaned closer to his computer, adjusted his thick glasses, and studied the record's photograph and description. What happened next would set in motion a federal investigation with a twist worthy of a classic radio drama. Golden exposed what authorities have called one of the most egregious instances of theft from the National Archives, where the government preserves billions of historic documents, photographs, and recordings. That investigation was scheduled to culminate in the sentencing in Greenbelt's federal court of a longtime archives official who has admitted to stealing nearly 1,000 recordings, many of them rare. In the courtroom, Golden, a respected radio historian, don't dare call him a collector, who may have been the only person capable of spotting the theft. He lives in a two-story Connecticut house that feels like a shrine to radio. His office is a studio that allows him to preserve and enhance classic records, and the walls are lined with framed albums of vintage radio broadcasts and other bits of nostalgia, including NBC's chimes and an on-air sign. A colorful radio is displayed on nearly every horizontal surface. Among them are a set that doubles as a humidor, and another called a May West that has a design feature you could put a brassiere on, Golden said with a laugh. There are some people who give us tips who are just passive. Golden wasn't like that, said the Archives Inspector General, Paul Breckfeld, whose office investigated the theft, and he plans to honor Golden for his help after the sentencing. He was a sentinel. The trip to the courtroom for Golden, who speaks in clipped New York City sentences that often end with a punchline, began the moment he became fixated on collecting old radio shows. The date was October 20th, 1955, his 13th birthday, and his mother had just given him a set that included a tape recorder. Soon he was recording classical music and radio dramas in his parents' Bronx apartment. By the time he graduated from Stuyvesant High School and New York University, he knew he was destined for a career in his favorite medium. Soon he was working as a disc jockey and radio engineer at small stations, including one in Sitka, Alaska, where he introduced programs in Tlingit, the language of the area's native population. As a radio engineer, he edited recordings, spliced tape, and calibrated audio machines. I'm not bragging when I say that I was the best tape editor in the business, Golden said. Yes, he is. He eventually joined large networks, including CBS, and became increasingly intrigued by old radio shows, particularly when he stumbled across their announcers or cast members. An announcer of the Lone Ranger, for example, turned over a trove of such recordings which he had stashed in a closet. It was one of Golden's most thrilling discoveries because he was such a fan of the show. With little prompting, he enthusiastically recites some of the program's most famous lines. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again. In his search for radio broadcasts, Golden was seeking master copies, most of which were made on 16-inch glass or aluminum disc covered in acetate. He enhanced the recordings and transferred them to reel-to-reel tape, which he used to create vinyl records and audio tapes to sell. By the late 1960s, he was operating a mail-order business called Radio Yesteryear that grew into a large firm, and he even won a Grammy Award in 1981 for producing a record of an old Orson Welles broadcast, Donovan's Brain. In the 1970s, as Golden amassed his massive collection, he decided to donate the master copies to the National Archives. In 1974, he drove to Washington in a rented van and handed several thousand recordings over to an affable and knowledgeable archivist named Leslie Woffen. The experience was so pleasant that Golden repeated the trip in 1976. In all, he says he gave the archives about 10,000 recordings. He and Woffen eventually dropped out of touch. After selling his business in 1998, Golden couldn't stop searching for old recordings and radios, and each evening he scours online auction sites. On September 27, 2010, he nearly added the Babe Ruth recording to his collection, but after just a few moments, he realized he knew the record well and even remembered parts of the broadcast. Well, the recording eventually sold on eBay for $34.74, a disappointing sum. It was Babe Ruth, and he certainly could have got a lot more than $34 for it, Golden said. But what really irked Golden wasn't the low price. He didn't even need to check his computer database to know that he had donated this very recording to the archives in 1976. At first, Golden thought the archives had decided to unload his recordings and that they had found their way to a dealer. He dashed off an irritated letter demanding that the government return anything it planned to sell. It was that letter that launched the criminal probe by the Inspector General. From the seller's eBay profile, Golden thought the dealer was a woman. The screen name was Hi-Fi Gal. Hoping to be helpful, Golden purchased a recording from Hi-Fi Gal, though not one of his donations. When it arrived in the mail, Golden ran the return address, Saddle Ridge Lane in Rockville, through a reverse directory. It came back to Leslie Woffen, who had retired the previous June as chief of the archive's audiovisual holdings. Golden was hurt. To have the chief of the henhouse stealing chickens, it's just disappointing, Golden said. Over the next 18 months, Golden helped authorities build their case, reviewing documents, submitting his original receipts from Woffen, and offering up experts to help sort and appraise the cache of 6,153 recordings seized from the retired archivist's home. When Woffen, 67, pleaded guilty in October to theft of U.S. government property, he admitted that he stole 955 items from the archives. Among them were original recordings of the 1948 World Series, which Golden had donated, and a rare recording of the 1937 Hindenburg disaster. In court filings, prosecutors alleged that Woffen stole 2,117 other recordings discovered in his house, and that the archivist sold more than 1,000. Woffen faces between 18 and 24 months in prison under federal sentencing guidelines. His attorney declined to comment, but in court papers described a dedicated volunteer still struggling with the death of his wife in 1988. Golden said, "He isn't too upset about what happened. I don't get angry," he repeatedly said in an interview, but he planned on attending Woffen's sentencing because, like any fan of a classic radio mystery show, he wants to know how this story ends. And that news story was entitled In National Archives Thefts, A Radio Detective Gets His Man by Del Quinton Weber and Lisa Rhine, published May 2, 2012. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
What Happened to Quality Radio by Sam Weaver.
veteran urban programmer turned talent coach Sam Weaver has some distinctive thoughts on how radio has evolved over the past 20 years, specifically since the Telecommunications Act of 1996. While it was presumed that the business side of broadcast radio would distinctly be impacted, he says, the creative side has actually been changed just as significantly, if not more so. Here are his thoughts on what happened to quality radio. Today, commercial radio is a corporate body with purpose and intentional activities. They include buying, selling, promising, and endorsing, as well as justifying its existence and attempting to influence legislation. Like other industries that have experienced changes due to government deregulation, we often find that broadcast management objectives greatly differ from those of the workers. In its current state, corporate radio does not appear to rely enough on the expertise of programming. Instead, some policies and regulatory situations have been created contrary to the creative process. In layman's terms, the men and women in management are put in the cart, the end result, before the horse, the process to achieve the end result. Radio attempts to provide a product that sales can then market to its advertisers, while programmers are told to get the most listeners they can get in their specific target demo. But the programming department is at the mercy of corporate lenders who, at times, have little or no experience in the creative process. Among the few exceptions are CBS Radio President and Chief Executive Dan Mason, Clear Channel CEO Bob Pittman, and the recent resigned Radio Division President of Radio One, Barry Mayo. Consumers, listeners, end up with a watered-down product because there is no balance between the sales and programming departments. Dictates from corporate seem to be solely monetarily motivated with minimum thought toward creative excellence. We have become a society of consensus and polling, where many are afraid to push the boundaries of traditional radio. The few innovative ideas and concepts seem to be for creating podcasts, online radio, and all things digital. Megacorporations are playing it safe with radio. It reminds me of a football team trying not to lose with its defense instead of playing to win with the offense. Apparently, the priorities are to stay on the air, spend as little as possible, and provide a space for advertisers. There is a direct correlation between this minimal thought process and the lack of quality programming on the airwaves. To understand why this is, we have to take a look back at the time when all things in radio as we knew it changed. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 was the first significant change in FCC law in more than 60 years. The new law sought to open competition in the communications markets. Not surprisingly, the law was looked upon favorably by media corporations. It led to a wave of mergers that resulted in decreased competition. Instead of many groups providing media services, the mergers brought the number of participants down to only a handful of radio companies. This has also resulted in fewer announcers, lower wages, and less creativity on the air. And now the industry wants even more deregulation. The National Association of Broadcasters has filed comments with the Federal Communications Commission that call for even more relaxed rules. According to the NAB, quote, "The existing local radio ownership rules are not necessary to promote the Commission's goal of competition, diversity, or localism," unquote. The fact that the NAB is lobbying for this pretty much speaks to the influence of the mega media corporations. Recently, Mount Wilson broadcast owner Saul Levine sent a protest letter to the National Association of Broadcasters threatening to cancel his membership.
He also indicated the NAB suggestion came without surveying its members. If the Federal Communications Commission follows through on the NAB request, it will help to drive out even more independent owners and further advance the decline of quality radio. Is this what the industry really wants? I don't think so. I believe that radio is resilient. It can overcome its own missteps. The major radio corporations are shining examples of capitalism. They have survived the recession, adjusted to Wall Street changes, and realigned their business model. But where is the creative juggernaut to help traditional radio propel itself forward? Everything appears more investor-oriented than listener-driven. This needs to change. Realistically, how much input do local programmers have anymore? The corporation is the king, which dictates such decisions as widespread use of syndicated programming and voice tracking on stations. In many instances, the stations impacted already had saleable ratings, and if the changes result in worse ratings, the only saving will be in salary, with no chance of an increase in revenue. National programming minds need to get rid of the, quote, one-answer-fits-all mentality, unquote. Some problems and solutions are local, and some are universal. There is a definite disconnect between megacorporation radio and quality programming. The cookie-cutter broadcast approach is only good to keep costs down. It's not going to help radio remain relevant to listeners in the future. The corporate pushdown has also impacted morale at stations. How often have you heard people say, "Radio isn't fun anymore"? Radio used to be an amazing career, the kind you would want to do even if you didn't get paid. The announcers would hang out because the atmosphere had more of the campus feel. These types of settings were perfect for jocks to express ideas that wound up on the air and, more importantly, put money on the books. There was a bond among co-workers, resulting in a passionate feeling about their workplace. Currently, you have to look to technology and social media industries to find that nurturing environment radio once had. Some examples include Apple, which has flex work hours, Microsoft, which provides free alternative therapies such as reflexology, massage, etc., and Google, which offers its employees free breakfast, lunch, dinner, and on-site massages, on-site fitness centers, flexible hours, as well as napping areas. These companies are creative factories where innovation translates into profit and where workers are treated as resources, not widgets. So what can we do in radio to bring back the creativity and fun once again? Companies, even those with stations in various cities and formats, could regularly hold brainstorming sessions locally and nationally. In either case, all the jocks in a cluster should be included without any other departments involved. Appoint one PD or jock to facilitate. These sessions could be held once a month with a focus on fun and sharing ideas. These kinds of brainstorming sessions should be different and separate than jock meetings, which tend to turn into dictates, complaining, and what not to do. I love radio, and therefore, I am still hopeful that radio corporations will push for new ways to include creative input. These companies are not the evil empire. It's just that, along the way, a lot of what made radio work has been pushed to the side. It should also be noted that there are some companies making tremendous strides with social media, digital expansion, and new technologies. However, for music stations, it's still about the music, and the jocks making the listening journey entertaining for the consumer. And that story was titled, What Happened to Quality Radio? By Sam Weaver.
This story is entitled, Dot-Dis, The Gentleman Hackers 1903 Lulls, from an article December 27, 2011 by Paul Marks. A century ago, one of the world's first hackers used Morse code insults to disrupt a public demonstration of Marconi's wireless telegraph. Late one afternoon in 1903, a hush fell across an expectant audience in the Royal Institution's celebrated lecture theater in London. Before the crowd, the physicist John Ambrose Fleming was adjusting arcane apparatus as he prepared to demonstrate an emerging technological wonder, a long-range wireless communications system developed by his boss, the Italian radio pioneer Guglielmo Marconi. The aim was to showcase publicly for the first time that Morse code messages could be sent wirelessly over long distances. Around 300 miles away, Marconi was preparing to send a signal to London from a clifftop station in Poldhu, Cornwall, United Kingdom. Yet before the demonstration could begin, the apparatus in the lecture theater began to tap out a message. At first, it spelled out just one word, repeated over and over. Then it changed into a facetious poem, accusing Marconi of diddling the public. Their demonstration had been hacked, and this was more than 100 years before the mischief playing out in the Internet today. Who was the Royal Institution hacker? How did the cheeky messages get there, and why? It had all started in 1887 when Heinrich Hertz proved the existence of the electromagnetic waves predicted by James Clerk Maxwell in 1865. Discharging a capacitor into two separate electrodes, Hertz ionized the air in the gap between them, creating a spark. Miraculously, another spark zipped between two electrodes a few meters away. An electromagnetic wave from the first spark had induced a current between the second electrode pair. It meant long and short bursts of energy, Hertzian waves, could be broadcast to represent the dots and dashes of Morse code. Wireless telegraphy was born, and Marconi and his company were at the vanguard. Marconi claimed that his wireless messages could be sent privately over great distances. I can tune my instruments so that no other instrument that is not similarly tuned can tap my messages, Marconi boasted to London's St. James Gazette in February 1903. That things would not go smoothly for Marconi and Fleming at the Royal Institution that day in June was soon apparent. Minutes before Fleming was due to receive Marconi's Morse messages from Cornwall, the hush was broken by a rhythmic ticking noise sputtering from the theater's brass projection lantern used to display the lecturer's slides. To the untrained ear, it sounded like a projector on the blink, but Arthur Block, Fleming's assistant, quickly recognized the tippity-tap of a human hand keying a message in Morse. Someone, Block reasoned, was beaming powerful wireless pulses into the theater, and they were strong enough to interfere with the projector's electric arc discharge lamp. Mentally decoding the missive, Block realized it was spelling one facetious word over and over, rats. A glance at the output of the nearby Morse printer confirmed this. The incoming Morse then got more personal, mocking Marconi. There was a young fellow of Italy who diddled the public quite prettily, it trilled. Further rude epithets from Shakespeare followed. The stream of invective ceased moments before Marconi's signals from Poldhu arrived. The demo continued, but the damage was done. If somebody could intrude on the wireless frequency in such a way, it was clearly nowhere near as secure as Marconi claimed, and it was likely that they could eavesdrop on supposedly private messages, too. Marconi would have been peeved, to say the least, but he did not respond directly to the insults in public. He had no truck with skeptics and naysayers. He said, "I will not demonstrate to any man who throws doubt upon the system." Fleming, however, fired off a fuming letter to the Times of London. He dubbed the hack scientific hooliganism and an outrage against the traditions of the Royal Institution. He asked the newspaper's readers to help him find the culprit. He didn't have to wait long. 4 days later, a gleeful letter confessing to the hack was printed by the Times. The writer justified his actions on the grounds of the security holes it revealed for the public good. Its author was Neville Maskelyne, a mustachioed 39-year-old British music hall magician. Maskelyne came from an inventive family. His father came up with the coin-activated spend-a-penny locks in pay toilets. Maskelyne, however, was more interested in wireless technology, so he taught himself the principles. He would use Morse code and mind-reading magic tricks to secretly communicate with a stooge. He worked out how to use a spark gap transmitter to remotely ignite gunpowder. And in 1900, Maskelyne sent wireless messages between a ground station and a balloon 10 miles away. But as author Sun Gook Hong relates in the book Wireless, his ambitions were frustrated by Marconi's broad patents, leaving him embittered toward the Italian. Maskelyne would soon find a way to vent his spleen. One of the big losers from Marconi's technology looked likely to be the wired telegraphy industry. Telegraphy companies owned expensive land and sea cable networks and operated flotillas of ships with expert crews to lay in service their submarine cables. Marconi presented a wireless threat to their wired hegemony, and they were in no mood to roll over. The Eastern Telegraph Company ran the communications hub of the British Empire from the seaside hamlet of Porthcurnow, West Cornwall, where its submarine cables led to Indonesia, India, Africa, South America, and Australia. Following Marconi's feat of transatlantic wireless messaging on 12 December 1901, the Eastern Telegraph Company hired Maskelyne to undertake extended spying operations. Maskelyne built a 50-meter radio mast, the remnants of which still exist, on the cliffs west of Porthcurnow to see if he could eavesdrop on messages the Marconi Company was beaming to vessels as part of its highly successful ship-to-shore messaging business. Writing in the journal The Electrician, on 7 November 1902, Maskelyne gleefully revealed the lack of security. "I received Marconi messages with a 25-foot collecting circuit, an aerial, raised on a scaffold pole. When eventually the mast was erected, the problem was not interception, but how to deal with the enormous excess of energy. It wasn't supposed to be this easy. Marconi had patented a technology for tuning a wireless transmitter to broadcast on a precise wavelength. This tuning, Marconi claimed, meant confidential channels could be set up. Well, anyone who tunes into a radio station knows that's not true, but it wasn't nearly so obvious back then. Maskelyne showed that by using an untuned broadband receiver, he could listen in. Having established interception was possible, Maskelyne wanted to draw more attention to the technology's flaws, as well as showing interference could happen. So he staged his Royal Institution hack by setting up a simple transmitter and Morse key at his father's nearby West End Music Hall. The facetious messages he sent could easily have been jumbled with those Marconi himself sent from Cornwall, ruining both had they arrived simultaneously. Instead, they drew attention to a legitimate flaw in the technology, and the only damage done was to the egos of Marconi and Fleming. Fleming continued to bluster for weeks in the newspapers about Maskelyne's assault being an insult to science. Maskelyne countered that Fleming should focus on the facts. "I would remind Professor Fleming that abuse is no argument," he replied. In the present day, many hackers end up highlighting flawed technologies and security lapses, just like Maskelyne did in 1903. A little mischief has always had its virtues. And that article by Paul Marks, senior technology correspondent for New Scientist, appeared on 27 December 2011 and was called Dot-Dis, The Gentleman Hackers 1903 Lulls. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
Best Buy is taking pre-orders for the new HD radio tabletop receiver called the Navigator, designed with the visually impaired in mind. The Narrator was created with input from the International Association of Audio Information Services, the group that represents radio reading services. The unit, marketed under Best Buy's Insignia brand, is unusual in that it's designed for both sighted and visually impaired users, according to Best Buy and Ubiquiti Digital. It's also the first Insignia brand HD radio receiver to include the AM band. With the narrator coming to market, people with visual disabilities will have a radio that they can program and tune themselves, says Dave Noble, chairman of government relations for IAAIS. For years, visually impaired listeners have had to use single-purpose, expensive SCA receivers that have lower quality audio. The IAAIS has pushed for an HD radio receiver designed with poor vision or blind users in mind so that listeners could have a regular radio. The buttons on the unit are larger than normal, with raised lettering. The units are shipped with the accessible mode as the default, so when a blind or visually impaired purchaser turns it on, he or she is prompted to tune the radio with voice commands, said Best Buy Senior Product Manager Mike Darnert. A sighted user can turn off the accessible voice command feature. This is also the first HD radio tabletop receiver that supports artist experience, in which the audio is synced with visual images. The regular pre-order price is $99. The units will start shipping in July and will be available for purchase on Best Buy's website. Ubiquiti will work with Alliance member stations to promote the radio on air. And that's all the time we have on this edition of the DX Audio Service. We'll simply say, we'll see you in July with a firecracker in hand. 73, good DX. Get out and support radio.
On KYW in Cleveland, Ohio.